I have a lot to be thankful for tonight. I'm thankful for America and thankful that we are able to resolve our electoral differences in a peaceful way.
Twice in the last 25 years, the United States has elected a president who received fewer votes than his opponent.
The forgotten men and women of our country will be forgotten no longer.
Is that a flaw in our democracy, or is it exactly what the founders intended?
When you look at the founders' debates and the Federalist Papers, it wasn't so much about majority rule.
This was a system built for a different time and a different place.
I'm Margaret Hoover. This is a special edition of the Firing Line podcast.
We're here at Hofstra University in front of a live student audience to discuss the arguments for and against the Electoral College.
On the stage at Hofstra, making the case to replace the Electoral College with a national popular vote, Jesse Wegman of the New York Times editorial board and author of the book, Let the People Pick the President.
All of our disputes, the bigger number always beats the smaller number. That's just the way it works. Any other system of counting, by definition, is going to treat certain votes as worth more than others.
Making the case to preserve the Electoral College, Trent England, the founder and executive director of Save Our States, and the author of the book, Why We Must Defend the Electoral College.
Arab Americans in Michigan, Hispanic voters in Texas. It's a good thing to have people thinking about those smaller groups of Americans rather than trying to just lump us into the biggest categories they can come up with or looking at us by the biggest media markets that are available.
And how do the students at Hofstra University see it?
Is it a legitimate fear that the continuation of the Electoral College could minimize the importance of the American right to vote, overall undermining democracy?
Jesse Wegman, Trent England, welcome to Firing Line.
Thank you.
We're here at Hofstra University in front of a live student audience to discuss the arguments for and against the Electoral College. But first, I want to set the table. Jesse, you are a member of the New York Times editorial board, and you have written a book, Let the People Pick the President. Your position as somebody on the New York Times editorial board is for the abolition of the Electoral College. And I think it's fair to point out that in the five times that the Electoral College has not reflected the popular vote of the people, two of those times were in the last 25 years, and the election did not go your preferred way. Trent, you run an organization out of Oklahoma that argues against the abolition of the Electoral College. And while you are from a red state, Republicans have only won one in the last eight popular elections. So, fair to say you both have a dog in this fight?
Sure, fair.
Okay, good. I'd like to begin with each of you, Jesse, then Trent. Give me your top three reasons for eliminating the Electoral College and for preserving the Electoral College. Jesse, you go first.
Sure. First, it's the right thing to do. A modern representative democracy. The way that we understand that today is elections that are run by majority rule, the person who gets the most votes wins, and political equality, which means all votes are treated as equal. And I think that's how we all just instinctively understand how elections should run. It's how every election in the country runs, except the biggest one of all. And I think that's the most obvious and the strongest argument is majority rule. The Electoral College obviously doesn't do that, so that's number two, is the ways in which the system is so flawed. And the argument there is, essentially, as we now know and we see happen every 4 years, is that a handful of states, maybe half a dozen, effectively determine the outcome of the election for the rest of us. What that means is 80% of the country is basically sitting on the sidelines and watching what happens in Phoenix or, Milwaukee or Atlanta. And it's just a massively unfair and undemocratic way to run an election when a few thousand people in a few randomly assorted parts of the country decide an election for 330 million people. And then the last argument I would make is the entire history of the Electoral College, the thing that we so often debate when we talk about what the Electoral College is and how it works and what it was meant to do, that history is often misunderstood. The history of it is actually different than I think what many Americans believe. And that's because the founders, when they were drawing up the American Constitution, had a lot of trouble figuring out how to elect the president. One of them said it was the hardest thing they had to do at the convention. They didn't do it until the final days. Really, they were running out the door. James Madison said, yeah, probably we were a little bit tired at that point. And there was no coherent principle behind it. They came up with sort of post facto explanations to sell the Constitution when they were trying to get it ratified. But really, the only arguable rationale on which the Electoral College was based was the idea that there would be this body of better educated, politically savvy men, only men, of course, only white men, of course, who would make this decision on behalf of the American people, many of whom might not be educated enough or just informed enough to make such a weighty decision. Even if that was the principle, and there's evidence that it wasn't entirely that, it was defunct in less than 10 years because something happened that none of the framers anticipated, which was the rise of national political parties. And with that, this idea of these sort of all-knowing, all-wise electors making this decision in the best interests of the country falls apart. And you end up with basically team sports, which is what happened in 1796, mm-hmm. For the first time, when George Washington was not on the ballot, mm-hmm. and there were two parties fighting against each other, and it's happening all the way up through today. So on just basic principles of majority rule, on the impact that we see that it has on the people, and on the actual history of why this even exists, I think all of those point strongly in favor of a national popular vote.
Trent, what are your top three reasons for preserving the Electoral College?
I think we should preserve the Electoral College because it makes our politics more national. I think it's very instructive that when you look at major democracies around the world, very few of them use a national level popular election for anything, right? Of course, most are parliamentary. The two constitutions written in the middle of the 20th century in India and Germany use a kind of an electoral college. Right. And so this idea that we use a two-step democratic election to prevent regionalism and therefore sort of promote national level politics, I think is very important. And we sort of miss it because the Electoral College has given us that blessing. Right. And so we don't we take it for granted. The second reason is that it also can make our politics more granular in ways that I think are beneficial, right? It helps various groups to get better heard. This is why civil rights leaders in the 1960s and 1970s were big defenders of the Electoral College, because they saw it as forcing the political parties, in particular the Democratic coalition, to listen to minority voices. And actually, some of those who wanted to get rid of the Electoral College were whites in the South who wanted to do that explicitly so they didn't have to listen to minority voices if they just had a national popular vote. The other thing is that the Electoral College protects our decentralized election system, right? Elections are all run within the states. That, I think, makes it a more robust system, right? There's not one computer that you have to hack into to attack American elections, right? This is run across the states. States, therefore, are allowed to have a lot of diversity and try different things. I think all of that, in the end, you know, we might not like what one state's doing or another state's trying, but in the end, I think it produces better elections than the alternative. So for those three reasons, I think the Electoral College is well worth preserving.
All right, let's go back to the beginning, because what's past is prologue. So let's start with the founding and the intention of the Electoral College. Trent, do you agree with the premise that Jesse says that the founders essentially scrapped this together in the waning moments of the convention, and that it never really worked beyond George Washington's term? Just from on a basic historical analysis point, are you guys on the same page there?
Not quite, because what Jesse, I think, neglects to mention is that the Electoral College, that system was something that, while they finished it at the end, they began talking about it in the very first week of the convention, right? So this is not something that they just hadn't thought about. They debated this over and over and over again during the convention. The first mention of something like an Electoral College came very early in the convention. And so while it did take them a long time to figure it out, it was a very thorny question. I think there was a lot of deliberation. And one of the core values, right, that came out of the convention through the compromise there was that they weren't going to create a system where the biggest states, the biggest population centers, could turn everybody else into serfs, right? Could basically amass enough political power that they didn't have to listen to anybody else. And, you know, particularly at the convention, it was small states versus big states. I think that goes to my first argument. I think that still matters, right? That we have a system that pushes political power outwards rather than allowing it to sort of, you know, regionalize.
So let me stop you there just because you got to explain that to me. Mm-hmm. If we have 10 battleground states every election cycle, how is it not regionalized now?
Well, those battleground states, first of all, are not a region, right? They're a very diverse group of states.
They're different regions, and they are different battleground states each time for the most part. I mean, they do tend to shift slowly over time, but that's still hyper-focusing on specific areas of the country rather than being a national election.
But
right?
But I think what people miss, you know, after the 2000 election, people said only Florida mattered. But that's not really true, right? Bush needed every state that he won. Right? If he hadn't flipped West Virginia.
And Al Gore needed Tennessee, which he didn't win.
Exactly, right? All those states matter. It's a question of sort of the time scale, right? The safe states, when you come right down to the election and you've got good polling, right, you know that you're going to focus here and not focus there. But the Democrats wouldn't be a credible national party if they didn't have California and New York, right? Republicans wouldn't be a credible national party if they didn't have Texas and Florida. Those states matter. They just don't matter right at the end. So I think the Electoral College really does force our politics over, you know, at least over the long run, to be more national than it would otherwise have to be. And that's why these other countries use similar systems.
We're going to get to this point about sort of the urban areas versus the rural areas. But Jesse, can you just respond to Trent's critique of the history around the founding and the Electoral College?
Sure. I mean, Trent's right that this was debated from week one all the way through. It just kept coming back up. I think it was debated on something like 21 separate days throughout the summer of 1787. They threw out probably 10 different alternatives for electing the president, including state legislators would do it, governors would do it, the people directly would do it. It would be done by congressional districts. So there were all kinds of proposals that lost for one reason or another. And in the end, I think, this is not my opinion. James Madison, you know, people call him the father of the Constitution, said this himself, that it was these decisions at the very end, in particular, the decision for how to choose the president was a function of their fatigue and impatience at the end of the process. And I just think, you know, what proves the point is that they didn't even agree with each other on what they were doing. So Alexander Hamilton, you know, in the Federalist Papers famously writes that the Electoral College is this excellent means of choosing the president, and it won't fail to select the most apt person for the job and someone who will represent the people well. And in private, he's writing letters to his fellow founders saying, this thing is going to blow up in our faces. Like, let's start gaming the system. He actually says, let's throw away some votes. In 1789, this is before George Washington is even elected for the first time, Alexander Hamilton is trying to basically game the system that they just designed in a way that he promised the people it was going to prevent, which is like a cabal, right? A backroom deal where people who have power are basically monkeying around with the thing to keep it from doing, you know, representing what the people want. So I think the fact that they didn't even agree with each other and weren't even being totally honest with the American people about what it was shows that there was no real principle behind it.
They were monkeying around with it to make sure the people got what they did want, which was George Washington elected rather than a tie between Washington and Adams, right? It wasn't, it's easy to present it as a cabal when you don't tell people what they were trying to do, right? They were trying to make sure that Washington became president because everybody wanted Washington to become president. And it was a problem that they fixed with the 12th Amendment, right? Which was that you were just casting these votes, right? And not distinguishing between vice president and president. And that was something that they fixed.
But all of that is premised on the idea that the electors would be these people who deliberated, right? Who were like the sort of civic virtue, the paragons of civic virtue who would make these decisions in the best interests of the country. And that just simply stopped happening in 1796. It's been now 228 years that it's not happening.
Okay, I actually want to get to what seems to me to be at the heart of the disagreement is the question of majority rule and whether the founders actually intended to have some kind of a break on majority rule. And there's a conservative argument. Actually, the founders didn't necessarily want majority rule. That's why they came up with this arcane system. Trent, is that your view? And Jesse, I'd like you to make the case for majority rule, but couch this in what the founders' intent was.
Sure. I think I'd put a little nuance in there, right, which is It wasn't, when you look at the founders' debates and the Federalist Papers, it wasn't so much about majority rule. I mean, obviously within an election, right, that's how you run an election, right? Within each state with the Electoral College, it's majority rule. They didn't talk so much about democracy as this mathematical construct. It was, how do you create representative and responsible government?
And that could be against the majority at times, according to them.
Absolutely. I mean, the parts of the Constitution we most revere are the ones that are flatly anti-majoritarian, right? That's the Bill of Rights. I mean, the Bill of Rights literally says, we don't care how big your majority is, here's a list of things you can't do through any democratic process. And so, you know, when you come to something like the Electoral College, where it's evolved to be more democratic than some of the founders thought it would be, and it creates this better, more national, more, I think, representative politics over time. I think that was in the founders' minds, right, when they created the Electoral College. And I think they also just recognized, right, that having a direct election had these real downsides, right? I would call them regionalism. They would call them, you know, big states controlling small states. And, you know, again, that's what we've seen in democratic country after democratic country. People recognize this downside in a large, diverse country of just going to the pure majoritarian principle.
If majority rule was so self-evident to the founders, why didn't they just do it?
So Trent's right that the Constitution is filled with anti-majoritarian elements, including the Bill of Rights, including the Supreme Court, including the Senate, most notably, I think. The very idea of checks and balances is, in some ways, is a buffer against just straight on majority rule, and I'm not arguing that those things don't exist. But I think why do we value majority rule so much? Right, we all instinctively value majority rule. It's the way we resolve all of our disputes. The bigger number always beats the smaller number. That's just the way it works. And why do we do that? Majority rule is the only way of counting that counts everybody's votes as equal. Any other system of counting, by definition, is going to treat certain votes as worth more than others. And I think that reality and the growing acceptance of broad political equality in this country, which is where we've gotten to after 230 some odd very difficult years, beginning with a time when obviously only a tiny fraction of the people were considered equal or considered political actors, you know, white men usually with property. I think that just is an illustration of where we've come over the course of American history, is that we've gotten to a place where political equality is the lodestar, and the only way to actually recognize political equality is through majority rule. So I actually agree with something Trent said a moment ago, which was that in elections, majority rule is the rule and should be the rule. And I think that's obviously true. It's shown by the fact that that's how we run every election. And I think we need to run the biggest election in the country that way as well.
One other point on the history that mm-hmm. that is particularly resonant in our contemporary debates is the notion that because of the Three-Fifths Compromise, the slave-owning states got a boost in the Electoral College because of the population and slaves in their states who could not vote. Jesse, for those who don't remember what the Three-Fifths Compromise is, what is the Three-Fifths Compromise?
So this was this iniquitous deal struck in the middle of the convention between the slaveholding states and the non-slaveholding states over how they could count their enslaved black populations. And what they agreed on was each black person would count for 3/5 of a free white person for the purposes of allocating representation in the House of Representatives.
Now, Jesse, you say it is an oversimplification to blame the Electoral College on slavery. Help put this in context.
Well, you're right. I mean, the states that the Constitutional Convention wanted a lot of different things. The slave states wanted to protect the practice of slavery, right? They were so jealous of that, of their practice of that, that they threatened to walk out of the convention multiple times throughout the summer. And the small states wanted equal power with the big states. As Trent's been saying, there was a lot of fighting between the small states and the big states. The overlap isn't perfect. It's not, you know, there's small slave states and there's large free states and vice versa. But all of these interests were fighting for a seat at the table and for power, mm-hmm. right? And when you get the two deals, the two compromises that happen at the middle of the convention, the sort of at the center of the whole deal, which is first, the creation of the House of Representatives with the three-fifths clause in place, which gives the southern states this boost, this extra political power based on their slave populations who obviously can't vote. And then the Senate, which gives the small states equal power with the big states, they don't want to give those powers up in the selection of the president. So it's not so simple as to say, oh, the Electoral College, slavery is what built the Electoral College. But the Electoral College, with the three-fifths clause, helped to preserve and expand the practice of slavery by electing slaveholding presidents, slaveholding chief justices, slaveholding speakers of the House, all the way up into the Civil War, right? Where I think for the first 40 years of the country's history, the president was a Virginia slaveholder with two exceptions, the two Adams. And so I think you can't talk about the history without including that component of it. And I think that's just another example of how this was a system built for a different time and a different place.
Trent, do you have any quibbles with Jesse's characterization?
I think Jesse does a really good job describing that part of the history. But I would throw in there, right, John Quincy Adams, the most clear beneficiary of the Electoral College in that time period, is one of those anti-slavery, I mean, not only a non-slaveholding president, right, but the most anti-slavery president, at least up to Lincoln. And then Lincoln is another beneficiary of the Electoral College. So it's, you know, I think those are important facts to consider in the history.
Okay. What if we had a national popular vote? Jesse, you posit that far more Americans would be involved. Why?
Well, we can see it right now. So we've talked about these battleground states, right? There's actually only about six this year, I think, realistically. And every 4 years, whichever states are the battleground states, have increased turnout, increased participation, higher voting numbers, right? Mm-hmm. And that's not some sort of strange phenomenon. It's very obvious. When people know their vote matters, they're more likely to vote, right? People here in New York are, you know, they say, it doesn't matter how I vote, if I'm a Democrat, if I'm a Republican, if I'm anything, it's not going to matter because New York's votes are going to go to the Democrat, right? And the same thing in Texas, right? In the reverse. So I think the evidence that people vote more, they turn out more, it's dramatically higher in those states, on the order of like 10% higher turnout. And so I think if you had a system in which everybody knew that their votes counted equally, and that the person who won the most votes in the country would be the winner, you then have that incentive throughout the country rather than just in a few random states scattered around the country that happen to have this almost exact equal number of Democrats and Republicans, thus leading to their battleground status and all the attention from both parties.
Trent, is it a misconception to say that under our current system, some votes just don't count?
Yeah, I think I live in a red state. When I vote for governor or when I vote for presidential electors...
I mean for president.
But the same thing happens, right? When I go to the polls and I cast a vote for a U.S. senator or governor or presidential electors, everybody knows what's going to happen in Oklahoma or in Vermont, right? There's none of those elections at any level, right, are in doubt. So it's funny to sort of single out the Electoral College and say, well, this election for presidential electors is unfair because we think we know the outcome in advance. I'm not disenfranchised when I vote for a gubernatorial candidate who's either a shoo-in or who's sure to lose, right? And, you know, I think it goes to maybe a lack of civic education that people just don't think about it in terms of voting for presidential electors. That may be a problem. But I also take issue with this idea that the whole country is going to be a swing state if we have a national popular vote.
Why?
Because the New York Times in 2016 helped Hillary Clinton lose the election by convincing her that there was no swinging that was going to happen. She was a shoo-in. Hillary Clinton was sure to win, right? We saw the little
fighting words. I think the New York Times editorial board needs to
Donald Trump thought the same thing.
That's right. But that was, I mean, the media was trying to convince Americans, right, that the election was done and dusted in October. And so the idea that if we had a national popular vote, the media would suddenly tell everyone, no, you should go out and vote. Nobody knows what's going to happen. Of course, that's not true. The media is going to have their polling.
Can we take the media out of it?
Yeah.
From the position
sure.
of the media.
Okay.
Let's take the media out of it.
Yeah.
How about, so literally, I mean, is it Are you then comfortable in the context of preserving the Electoral College, if it is true, the statistic that Jesse shares, that in battleground states, participation, voter participation is 10% higher?
It's slightly higher. I mean, Vermont typically has higher voter turnout, very safe state, than some swing states, right? Because Vermont just has very high voter participation. Fair?
In part because Vermont has good voting laws. I'm not saying in every case the swing state, I'm saying on average, swing states average about a 10% higher turnout than non-swing states, safe states.
A lot of those swing states have higher turnout in other elections too, right? So it's not just about the presidential election. It's also that people don't know who's going to win the governor's race,
but
right?
In a state that is more evenly divided, you have a higher participation.
Yeah, for all kinds of reasons. Okay.
The debate over the Electoral College is not new, of course. William F. Buckley Jr. hosted a firing line conversation about the Electoral College and its value in 1976. Here he is addressing the Electoral College with his guest, the writer and columnist Richard Reeves. Take a look.
No one would ever go into large stretches of this country, exactly, if it were not for the Electoral College. Nobody would ever go to Montana, Wyoming, if it weren't. They wouldn't go to the Deep South. They'd go to Atlanta, get the television reach from there, which will get greater. And that's one argument for, in some way, trying to give the states a role.
Going there is a code word for offering them something, isn't it? It doesn't really matter if they go to Montana, but it matters a lot if they don't take the main industries of Montana for granted. Whether it's recreational parks or beef or whatever.
I think there is more value than that in going. I mean, it's a hackneyed argument, but in the end, I suppose it didn't change a lot. But John Kennedy did go to West Virginia, and he saw things that he never in his life could have seen. And I think that as bad as the campaigning process is and as encapsulated as it is, they do see things that they wouldn't.
Trent, do you want to take that one?
Yeah. I think there's some truth to it. I think it's an easy, sometimes overstated argument, right? Because all campaigns, whether you're running for governor in Oklahoma or Senate in California or president of the United States, focus on some areas versus other areas, right? So clearly, if you switch from the Electoral College to a national popular vote, candidates are still going to travel, they're still going to do events, they're going to do them in different places, right? To focus on, you know, some states are going to lose, well, some states are going to win, right? I mean, that's clearly a part of the political dynamics of this debate. But I think it is true, right? He mentioned Atlanta. You would see the campaigns shift to wherever the perceived cost of flipping votes is cheaper, right? Which probably means places where there's a lot more people. When I ran for office many years ago and went knocking on doors, right, I didn't go to the houses with the long driveways and big dogs. I went to the subdivisions, right? To the apartment buildings, if you could get in there, right? I mean, that's how a campaign works in that setting. And the campaign for president is going to work out that way, right? You're going to figure out where to go. National popular vote just shifts that a lot more to the big cities.
Jesse, take this idea that, like, if I'm a Democrat, why don't I just go drive up the participation of voters in urban areas where I know there are a ton of Democrats who aren't always turning out because the state's not that valuable? Los Angeles, Detroit, you know, and you tackle this in your book. Take on this argument for us here now. Why, if I'm a Democrat, do I not just drive up my vote in the densely populated areas where I know there are more supporters for me and skip the Oklahomas and the South Dakotas altogether?
So I'm going to preface this with a somewhat tendentious comment, which is, so what? So what if a lot of people live in the cities? Everybody counts the same. It doesn't matter where people live. What matters is everybody counts the same. Everybody's vote is equal.
But with finite resources, a campaign could have better bang for the buck in a densely populated area than having to go sweep up a bunch of votes in North Dakota, South Dakota, Wyoming, Idaho, Montana.
Well, let me say two things about that. First of all, in response to the video and to that clip, you know, that what they're saying there, there's some accuracy in it, and then there's some inaccuracy in it. The accuracy is that, candidates don't go to certain places, right? And that there's benefit to people going to certain places, both in terms of what they pay attention to, and as Reeves said at the end, what they learn about the country just by visiting and meeting people on the ground in all different parts of the country. Absolutely agreed. What I don't agree with and just as factually incorrect, is the Electoral College is not why they go and visit, or the absence of the Electoral College would not stop them from visiting all those places. They don't visit those places now. Something like 96% of campaign visits and dollars, ad spending, all of that, all the strategizing goes into just the few swing states, right? Everybody else is basically forgotten about. And that has real policy implications. This isn't just like a vanity contest. This isn't just who gets the most, you know, who gets the most face time with one candidate or the other. This has actual implications. And I'll just to give you a quick example, you know, Donald Trump, as in so many ways, you know, is a great civics lesson for us. When he was president in 2017 or 18, there were some horrible wildfires that swept through California, killing dozens of people, destroying homes, destroying forests. I mean, it was really an awful, awful catastrophe. And he said openly, he said, "Why?" Basically, I'm paraphrasing here, but why would I go help them? That's a blue state. They're not going to vote for me anyway. And it's like, thank you, Mr. Trump, once again, for just laying out there openly what, you know, what we've all been trying to say for so many years.
Well, let me ask the flip side of this question to both of you, but I'll go to you, Trent, first. I mean, the argument that you have made and others on the conservative side of this question have made is that, ironically, or maybe this was by design or not, from time to time, small groups of ethnic minorities actually do have outsized leverage because of the Electoral College. I'm thinking now of, in the case of Michigan, of the Arab American population. The Arab American population in Michigan is 3% of the state of Michigan. They make up 240,000 Michiganders. Joe Biden won that state by 150,000 votes in 2020. He needs those votes if he's going to win Michigan as a battleground state in 2024. And the Arab American population in Michigan is dissatisfied with Joe Biden's support for Israel and his perceived lack of sympathy for the plight of the Gazans in the current Israel-Hamas conflict. Would Joe Biden have any incentive to listen to those Arab Americans as closely as he is now if Michigan were not a battleground state?
No, right. And this goes to my point about the Electoral College making our politics sometimes more granular. You know, people have complained that lobster fishermen in Maine have gotten attention from the White House because Maine's second congressional district can be a swing district. Arab Americans in Michigan, Hispanic voters in Texas, right? Republicans, to make sure that they hold on to Texas, have gone to great lengths to recruit Hispanic candidates, right? To reach out to the region of Southern Texas where they've made great inroads. I think those are all good things. And I think that they're a side effect, right, of this system where you have a bunch of states, whether it's Texas and the Republicans are trying to hold on to what supposedly is a safe state, or Michigan where it's likely to be a swing state. It's a good thing to have people thinking about those smaller groups of Americans rather than trying to just lump us into the biggest categories they can come up with, or looking at us by the biggest media markets that are available.
Jesse, in a national popular vote, why wouldn't Joe Biden just go find 150,000 other votes from somewhere else in the country if the Arab American population in Michigan he can't quite have a good enough answer for right now?
This doesn't have to be an either or, right? The presidents should always pay attention to Americans everywhere and
but
be concerned.
But if Arab Americans are 1% of the U.S. population, why not just replace that 1% with a different group that's easier for him to answer to?
I don't think that realistically happens. So you look at gubernatorial races, right? Trent brought up gubernatorial races a few minutes ago. Gubernatorial races are a decent proxy for our presidential race, right? There's a jurisdiction, there's one person running to lead it, and everybody's vote is equal, and the person who gets the most votes wins, right? So let's look at how do they actually campaign in places that have something like a national popular vote, just on the state level. And the answer is they go everywhere. They talk to everybody, and they do it in basically rough proportion to where people live. If 25% of the population of a state is in the urban areas, they spend about 25% of their time and focus on urban areas. 25% in rural areas, same thing there. It's remarkable how good they are at doing this. And it's also not a surprise. This is their job. Their job is to appeal to people, to show them that they care about what they're concerned about, and to get their votes, right? So the idea that somehow, because Arab Americans this year or African Americans and Jewish voters in the 60s should have an outsized influence in choosing the president just because of where they happen to live. In the 60s, it was African American and Jewish voters in New York. New York actually was a swing state, believe it or not. It was the most important swing state through the middle of the 20th century. I know it seems weird now, but the presidents of both parties spent a huge amount of their concern focused on New York. There, you know, there's some evidence that the Civil Rights Act, you know, was somewhat of a play for votes by LBJ. Like, you know, this it's not a surprise that they do it this way, except it's not a defense either to say that because a certain group living in a certain place wields a certain outsized influence just because of the mechanism that we use for electing the president is not an argument for doing it that way. All it means is that certain people count more and other people count less.
Judge, one quick response, because then we're about to go to students. Go ahead.
The concern that civil rights leaders had, though, in the 60s and 70s was that it would be very easy to have minority groups not integrated or de-integrated from American politics if the parties didn't have this particular incentive, right? And some of the black leaders were open that they worried that you'd have some black splinter party that would develop. And then, you know, under a national popular vote system, the Democrats could win with 45% or the Republicans could win with 45%. And they could both sort of mutually agree to ignore that group or some other group of voters. Whereas with the Electoral College, we had what you just described, right? Which was both of the parties trying to figure out, how do we pull these people into our coalition? I want a political system like that, where they're looking to pull people into their coalitions rather than a national popular vote where they could win with potentially a small plurality or with regional support from, you know, whether it's the Deep South or the coast or some other region.
Okay, we're going to hold it there because we're going to go to student questions. Please introduce yourself and ask your question.
Hi, my name is Aruna and I'm a junior here at Hofstra. I'd like to address my question to Mr. England. In light of the 2000 and 2016 elections, when the winner of the popular vote lost, many voters raised the concern that they felt that their vote simply did not matter. Is it a legitimate fear that the continuation of the Electoral College could minimize the importance of the American right to vote, overall undermining democracy?
Trent, go for it.
So this is where Americans need to understand how our elections work and how our Constitution works, right? If you had an uprising of Americans who wanted to establish a church, and we had public opinion polls that showed that 60% of Americans want to establish a church or deport a particular minority group, right? We would say, well, it's a failure of democracy that we have a Bill of Rights that stops the majority from doing that, right? When the Speaker of the House gets elected by a party that won the most seats but didn't receive the most popular votes, sometimes you hear little rumblings about this, that that's not fair. But by and large, most Americans understand that's just how that election system works. We vote for president by voting for presidential electors in our states. The presidential electors go on to vote for president. I think if we understand how that system works, we can debate whether we like the two-step democratic process. But it is a democratic process, right? It's not an undemocratic process. It's just a democratic process in stages.
Jesse, do you want to reply?
Yeah, let's talk about federalism, right? The design of the American system of government, right? You have two tiers. You have the states, and then you have the federal government. The federal government is supreme over the states. That's the way it was designed. And if there was any question about it, we fought a war over it, and the federal government won, okay? So that's as a baseline. Next, how do we elect people to all the various offices in those two tiers of government? We have mayoral elections. You have school board elections at the local level. You have elections for your state legislators at the state level. You have elections for governor. You have elections for your Congress people. You have elections for the senators. All of those elections happen within state boundaries, right? And that is designed that way, and it makes sense, because these states get to exist as these discrete political units in that setting and as states, right? But when you have the federal government supreme again over the states, you have the leader of the federal government, the one person whose job it is to represent all Americans equally, not just some Americans, not just Arab Americans in Dearborn or, you know, white Americans in Phoenix or whatever it might be. You have a person who needs to be elected by all of those people voting together in one plebiscite, all votes counting equal, and the person who gets the most votes wins, all right? So I don't think a national popular vote is in any way going to undermine the system of federalism that characterizes our government. In fact, it is just the proper way to elect the leader of the country, the one person who represents all Americans equally.
We have one more student question. Please introduce yourself and ask your question.
I'm Christian David Harris. I'm a drama mass media senior here at Hofstra. And my question actually is for Jesse, and it pertains to the three-fifths compromise conversation you had earlier. My question is, given that history, and even though obviously the three-fifths compromise isn't here now, Black votes are still somewhat submerged in those southern states. So I wanted to know if the Electoral College were to not be abolished, what like strategies or like ways could you change the Electoral College to like avoid future submersion?
I'm sorry, you're saying if the Electoral College were still in effect or
like
were
if
not?
If it weren't to be abolished, like
or weren't abolished.
Yeah, just
Is there a reform to the Electoral College that could?
The short answer is no. The reforms that would make any meaningful difference, particularly for, say, the millions of Black voters in the South, could not. The only way they would really make any meaningful difference on a national level would be if it happened nationally, right? A state can certainly change its own method of allocating electors. That's a very clear power that states have. But unless it were to happen nationally, it's a basically, you know, unilateral disarmament, and it wouldn't work. But I just want to point out, I mean, you raise a really good point there, which is the way in which, in this case, Black voters' ability to have a say or have a voice in the outcome of an election is thwarted. You know, the three-fifths clause was bad enough, but what people who study the history of this often like to say is that after the three-fifths clause, after the Civil War and the Reconstruction Amendments were in place, we had what was effectively a five-fifths clause. Mm-hmm. Because when Reconstruction fell apart and the federal government decided it wasn't going to protect Black voters in the South anymore, the Jim Crow begins basically disenfranchising for 80 more years the entire Black population, Black male population of those states, even though those states could now count those voters, those individuals, as full people rather than 60% of a person, right? So in fact, the South got even more power after the Civil War. So we always have to be aware of how certain voters' voices and their existence is affected by the means by which our voting process happens. And it's why it matters so much today when we debate voter suppression laws or ways in which certain people are kept out of the ballot box and away from having political power. So I think it's a great question, and there is no clean way to do it in the South, particularly, which is still overwhelmingly white on a state level, without getting rid of the Electoral College.
Trent, do you want to add anything there?
I think that Jesse's spot on with the history, right? I mean, that's what we saw in the Jim Crow era was a five-fifths, you know, situation where voters were counted but not allowed to participate.
Listen, you two have demonstrated that coming from very different perspectives, you can sit down and engage in civil discourse. So thank you for modeling that for us and for the students here. But I think the final question I have for both of you is, being familiar with the other's body of work, is there an argument that they have made, either tonight or previously, that gives you pause? Or that you think is a particularly strong argument? Trent, Jesse, who goes first?
Well, I mean, I'll go. I mean, I think the argument for, because I've also done some work that's very skeptical of ranked choice voting and other election reform that's out there. And my criticism is around the complexity of it. I mean, I get the argument that sort of how I see the majoritarian argument is more an argument for simplicity, right? A simpler, easier to understand election process. I think everything else being equal, and obviously I don't think it is, but is superior, right? And is more democratic in the sense that things are democratic and people can understand them, right? And I think that's a legitimate concern about you know, the Electoral College that I hear from Jesse.
Jesse, I'm not asking you to change your mind. I'm just saying, is there a persuasive point that Trent makes that your side could argue better?
Sure. I mean, I was watching YouTube videos the other day of someone trying to ask Trump supporters if there was anything on the other side that they could agree with. And then they all said no. And I thought, oh, you guys, you know, come on. And now that you're—
Stay tuned for our next debate.
Now that you're asking me, I'm like, oh, it's not as easy as— no, but I think what, to be fair, you know, Trent's focus on the states as discrete political units really, I think, I'm moved by that. I love the fact that we have these different states that are made up of really diverse groups of people and cultures and geographies and histories. And obviously many of the states are just sort of the state lines. What one of the things that bothers me is the state lines are completely arbitrary in many cases and were drawn for, you know, nakedly political reasons. And why does the two Dakotas have twice as many senators as California? We could go on and on. But the bottom line is I agree that having this diversity of states and cultures and regions in this country is a huge strength to the American electorate and to the American people. The only thing I don't agree with is that they should have any sort of equal footing. I think they should be treated proportionally to their populations.
All right. Well, with that, Trent England, Jesse Wegman, thank you for bringing your thoughts and your formulated opinions to this conversation. And to the students of Hofstra University, thank you for joining us. That's a wrap.
Thank you.